Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking with the author of Latino Mass Mobilization, Immigration, Racialization, and Activism. The book is published by Cambridge University Press. The author is Chris Zepeda Mayan. Chris, how are you doing today?
Great. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. And as we were just talking before we started, this is a book that I really enjoyed because I've thought about similar types of issues, and you've written such an interesting and timely book. Before we get to the substance of the book, maybe you can share just a little bit about yourself. Tell us about yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm an assistant professor and political scientist in the Department of Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley. I received my PhD from the Department of Government at Cornell University. And I'm also the faculty chair of the Center for Research on Social Change at UC Berkeley.
Yeah, fantastic. I always love reading the acknowledgement sections of books, and the list of people that you thank along the way is so long and numerous. You have, I suspect, been touched by and supported by and supported so many people. You're very gracious in your acknowledgement section of the people in your past that have supported you. So let's talk about this really interesting and also very timely book. The book is primarily about the period of 2006 and afterwards, but you begin the book with a history of the immigrant rights movement from 1965 to 2005. Why is this the right time period to track this history? And after you sort of maybe talk a little bit about that, who are some of the major players in the movement during this time period, especially those representing Latino immigrants?
Sure. So I think throughout American history, right, there's always been what we could call episodes of immigrant activism. Some of the most famous examples being things like the Chicago Haymarket Affair in the late 1800s or the Bisbee Revolt in Arizona in the early 1900s. And just like today, detention, deportations were often used against them for their activism. But they were never really seen as, and I don't think they really saw themselves as a unified or national social movement focusing specifically on the rights of the foreign-born. Right, so I think more often than not, they saw themselves as unionists or anarchists or acting on behalf of specific ethnic groups, right? But what we understand today as the modern immigrant rights movement, which I think focuses primarily on the issue of immigrant illegality, is a more recent phenomenon that I think could be arguably traced back to the late 1960s and 70s when changes to U.S. immigration laws resulted in not the prevention, but in the criminalization of the Mexican labor force that Americans were using and were dependent on. Right, so I think this is when we begin to see the first sustained organizing of undocumented immigrants by people like the pioneering organizers that I talk about in the book, specifically Burke Corona and Chole Alatorre. So, for example, and I identify them as being primary because even though they were primarily based out of Los Angeles, I got to interview Chole Alatorre maybe about 8 years ago, and she was telling me that the issue of illegality was so new, nobody knew how to organize around it. And when people found out that they were doing it successfully in Los Angeles, she was all actually flying out to places across the country, including New York City, to organize the first undocumented immigrant groups across the nation. Right. So I think LA really created the template for the modern day immigrant rights organizing and a lot of the frames that are often still used today.
Now, out of this history comes the very significant protests and activism of 2006. What was the common target of those quite varied protests? They all come together in response to some very specific actions. What were those? What take us to that time period of 2006?
Yeah, so I think the 2006 protest wave was sparked by H.R. 4437, also known as the Sensenbrenner Bill, which was a draconian piece of anti-immigrant legislation passed by the U.S. House of Representatives, led by the Republican Party at the time, in December of 2005. Among its most punitive provisions, I think the bill sought to not only increase the penalty of being undocumented from a civil violation into a federal felony, but it also wanted to punish anyone who helped or associated with undocumented people in the most basic ways, right? And they wanted to punish them pretty severely with thousands of dollars of fines and even incarceration. And so this would have potentially criminalized everyone from priests and teachers to doctors, employers, social service providers, and even the family members of people without papers. Right, so the 2006 demonstrations were primarily a response to this bill, but also in response to the need for immigration reform that included a path to citizenship for the nation's undocumented immigrants.
Now, you also described these protests and the activists who took part in them as unexpected. What was unexpected about the people who led the mobilization and activism in 2006? This is not necessarily the people who had been active and who we might expect based on social science theory.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the quantitative research at the time had shown us that Latinos in general, but Latino immigrants in particular, were amongst the least likely people in the United States to partake in political activism, right? They're new to the country. They don't really understand the political system. They want to kind of not get in trouble, right? And do anything that's going to draw attention to them, right? So not surprisingly, most studies had found that Latinos in general, but Latino immigrants in particular, didn't really partake in contentious politics. In fact, during this period, the largest public opinion poll on Latinos, Latino National Survey, was being taken, and it actually didn't even include any questions related to political activism because they thought, well, Latinos this isn't really a type of political behavior that Latinos participate in, so let's not even include it in our survey, all right? And then in the middle of all of this, right, you have the largest protests in Latino political history happening, right? And it's, yes, you know, it was oftentimes called for by, you know, some of these traditional activist organizations, but the vast majority of participants and the protests organized were organized by what I call unexpected political actors, right? We're talking about people like small business owners, day laborers, nannies, veterans, you know, people who usually don't partake in politics in the Latino community, but this time came out, right? And then they came out not only because the bill would have impacted them, again, criminalizing not only undocumented people, but anybody who interacted with them, but also because of how the bill and actually the whole debate at the time was what I call being racialized. All right. So at the time, if you remember, the Republican Party went from attacking undocumented immigrants specifically to then kind of demonizing immigrants in general, to then criticizing things like bilingual education and what they called the browning of America, right? Saying that Latinos weren't assimilating like previous immigrant groups and they were a danger. Right. And I think a lot of us forget, you know, how the role that the English language media played in this, right? You had news anchors on mainstream media channels like CNN, you know, Lou Dobbs, promoting conspiracy theories, saying that Mexican immigrants and Chicanos, Mexican Americans, were all part of this secret plot to take over the Southwest, right? So all of this was happening at the time, and it made it easier for activists to reach out to traditionally non-political segments of the Latino community, which included not only undocumented immigrants, but also second and third generation Latinos, which research had showed don't really identify with the immigration issue. But it helped activists tell them, like, hey, this has less to do with public policy and more to do with who you are, how you look, you know, the languages you speak, where your family comes from. All right. So I think the combination of the direct and collective impacts of the censor burner bill really helped mobilize traditionally non-politically active communities.
You know, this idea of the unexpected activists and players in this round of and wave of protests also relates to some of your methods that you use in this book. And where you chose to investigate. You mentioned Los Angeles and New York, but you also studied in Florida. I wonder if you talk a little bit about how you did this work. This is extensive interviews included. Would you talk a little bit about why these three places, and also, how you conducted and how you learned about this?
Sure. Again, most of the literature at the time on Latino political activism was really historically based, right? It was based on the 1960s Chicano movement and the Puerto Rican movement and these kind of historic events, right? There wasn't a lot of work being written on Latino activism outside of labor union activism. So in 2006, right, there was so many protests happening in not only the traditional gateway cities like Chicago and New York and LA, but also, in fact, the vast majority of the protests happened in outside of these gateway cities. They happened in the rural Midwest and actually the U.S. South. Right, so this was really surprising to academics and even activists themselves, right? Because it wasn't them, the traditional activists, organizing them. Again, it was sometimes mom and pop store owners, local community residents doing these things. And so theoretically, I thought it was important for to kind of just get a sense of what was going on. To look at places like Los Angeles, where we would expect immigrant mass mobilization to occur, because it's a large immigrant population. It has a long history of immigrant activism. It has dozens of immigrant rights organizations, right? So if immigrant mass mobilization was going to happen, we would expect it to happen in a place like LA. And it did happen in a place like LA, right? Where upwards to 500,000 to over 1 million people took to the streets. New York was selected for the same reasons. New York arguably has an even larger immigrant, New York has an even larger immigrant population, arguably an even longer history of immigrant activism and more immigrant rights organizations and coalitions. But unlike Los Angeles and Chicago and Dallas, New York came relatively late to the protest wave, and their demonstrations were nowhere close to the size of other immigrant metropolises. At the same time, New York had the most diverse protests in the country during this period, right? So I wanted to kind of investigate, one, why New York didn't mobilize to the same degree as other major immigrant cities, and also the role that diversity and demographics played in the mobilizing process. And Fort Myers was chosen for completely different reasons. Fort Myers was an unexpected location for migrant mass mobilization. Fort Myers is considered a new immigrant receiving destination. Right, there was no real history of immigrant activism or established immigrant rights organizations there. And yet this city of, I think it was about 60,000 people, which according to the census is only 10% Latino, had a demonstration of 75 to over 100,000 people there, right? So that one I think was interesting. That case was interesting to me because it was an unexpected location. It was in the South. Didn't have a history of activism, and yet they had a mass mobilization there. And then interestingly enough, what I found there that the leading actors and networks there weren't, these professional social movement organizations that parachuted in to organize, this vulnerable population. It was local immigrant community members themselves who used things like soccer leagues, local small businesses, and their own personal family and social networks to mobilize their communities.
You also write of the importance of the ethnic media. How did the ethnic media play a part here? Because we typically think of social movements as successful when they kind of are picked up by the more general mainstream media, but the ethnic media plays a special role here. Would you talk a little bit about that, and also the types of media that were most important during this time period?
Yes, I think that's completely correct. The ethnic media played a vital role in the protest wave. So usually activists have to spend a lot of time organizing and planning demonstrations in hopes of getting a lot of people to turn out. Now, one of the reasons why they want a lot of people to turn out is because they know that it will increase the chances of the media covering their events, right? And for them, it's important to get media coverage because this is their chance to highlight the issues, right, that they want to get out there. And even then, when media shows up to cover their demonstrations, it's oftentimes hard for activists to get the media to cover the issues in the same way that they would like them to, right? Often it's the opposite. The media doesn't cover the issue the way activists would want them to, right? 2006 was different because you had Spanish language corporate mass channels of communications literally promoting the protests, running promo commercials all day long, encouraging their viewers to participate in these demonstrations, right? You had activists on mainstream Spanish language radio stations, right, taking over the airwaves for 3, 4, 5, 6 hours at a time, framing the issues, answering callers' questions, trying to convince listeners of the importance to demonstrate against the Sensenbrenner bill and in favor of legalization, right? So this is something that was pretty kind of historic in American, contemporary American social movement history. And I think it was especially interesting because at the time, a lot was being made about the importance of new media and the internet as the next big tool for activists, right? Which arguably has been. But in the case of the 2006 immigrant rights protest wave, it was actually old and traditional media outlets like newspapers and entertainment radio programs that were the most important ways that organizers got the word out to the immigrant masses.
Now, as you noted earlier, the Sensenbrenner bill appears in December 2005, and many of the protests begin in 2006. In the book, you also connect the protests and activism to voting in the 2006 election and then the 2008 election. How are these related? What was the relationship between this high level of contentious politics and the more traditional form of politics that we expect related to voting? Maybe you can tie some of those things together for us.
Sure. So this also comes back to California and the last time we had, or one of the first times we had this major anti-immigrant laws being proposed. And here I'm talking about Proposition 187 in the mid-90s in California, which was similar to the Sensenbrenner bills in many ways. It was criminalizing undocumented people and anybody who associated with them. And what happened in California is that you saw massive protests occur. I think it was something like 500,000 people in Los Angeles. But what we saw subsequent to that, despite the proposition being passed because of the size of the Latino electorate at the time was unable to prevent it, in the years following Prop 187, you saw massive Latino citizenship, voter registration, and get out the vote drives that have arguably transformed California politics, now making the Latino political caucus there the largest and one of the most obviously, or arguably one of the most important and strongest political caucuses in California state politics, right? So a lot of the organizers of the 2006 demonstrations in Los Angeles and in California knew that, right? So after the Sensenbrenner bill, they immediately thought like, oh, okay, this is the same thing's going to happen again, right? Latinos are going to become citizens and they're going to go out and vote and we're going to try to change this time national politics, right? Unfortunately for them in 2006, during those midterm elections, the Latino vote didn't have the impact that they said. You know, some activists claimed that they were going to have 1 million new voters, right? And they weren't able to register that many new voters at the time. But the same coalitions and organizational structures that were solidified or created to coordinate the 2006 protests were subsequently used to launch these massive and historic Latino naturalization, voter registration, and get out the vote drives during the 2008 election. And this was in combination with those mass channels of communication, the Spanish language media outlets that I mentioned earlier, right? So both the activists and the media outlets institutionalized their efforts and redirected their energies to electoral politics.
Now, we're a couple of years, not that long out from 2006 and from the 2008 election, but we seem to be in a very different point. In the interest of wrapping up our conversation, where are these activists and where is the social movement today related to the Trump administration, the new politics of immigration and immigration policy right now? Connect us to our current moment, maybe, if you might, related to the research that you did on this earlier time period.
Sure. So I think right now I've actually been doing some interviews and research on the contemporary movement and activists. And what we found in a poll, I just did a survey where I added some questions examining contemporary Latino support for immigrant activism. And still today, the majority of Latino voters support immigrant rights activism and immigrants in general. Right? But in terms of the actual social movement itself, obviously the election of Donald Trump was a devastating blow to the movement. And we've seen that no other segment of society has been targeted arguably more by Donald Trump since taking office than the immigrant community. At the same time, I think Trump's victory kind of overshadowed some important gains that the immigrant rights movement made during the last election, right? They have the first Latina senator, right, win, and I believe in Nevada, right? You had the notorious sheriff, Jor Arpaio, you know, voted out of office by the immigrant rights movement in Arizona, right? You had the immigrant-heavy states that used to be swing states of New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada, which once again were solidly Democrats because of the Latino and immigrant votes, right? So the Latino, at least at the electorally, the immigrant rights movement, you know, had some important victories at the local and state level. Nationally, though, they've realized that, okay, the political opportunity structure is closed right now at the federal level, right? So a lot of what they're doing is they're trying to build and expand their bases to new areas outside of California, outside of New York, right? They're trying to build their bases in the South, in places where Donald Trump won, where there's immigrants there, right? Where a lot of times the immigrant rights movement hadn't really invested in creating organized bases there. They're currently doing that now, right? The Dreamers, organizations like United We Dream, are expanding their bases to the South and to the rural Midwest. The other tactic or strategy that the immigrant rights movement is doing is they're trying to focus on areas where they can expand immigrant rights. In California, for example, in response to Trump, you have a progressive state legislator that wants to be seen as leading the resistance against Donald Trump. So right now, interestingly enough, although the political opportunity structures are closed at the federal level, in places like California, it's actually opened up. You have state legislators that were unwilling to pass pro-immigrant laws, immigrant rights laws that were going to be contradictory or attack the Obama administration are now willing to do so. Right? They want to prove their anti-Trump credentials through passing progressive immigration laws, right? And I think you see that most in California. And the immigrant rights movement, I think right now, is having this what I would call a three-prong approach, where they're one, trying to get legislative victories where they can in progressive states like California that are now more open to them passing these types of laws, expanding their base being the second, I think, that they're focusing on, especially in the South and in the rural Midwest and in places where Trump won. And thirdly, I think they're focusing on electoral politics. They're realizing that, you know, protests, activism, all of that is less, it's important and has to continue to be done, but it's less effective right now in pressuring the Trump administration to do anything. The only thing that both political parties are going to pay attention to is electoral power and electoral weight. Right. So I think a lot of times in a lot of places across the country, you're seeing this more kind of quiet form of activism where they're trying to register people. They're trying to impact local elections.
Yeah. This really interesting book, Latino Mass Mobilization, Immigration, Racialization, Activism, is published by Cambridge University Press and available widely. Chris, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.